traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Show up and run the vibe with Bose SoundLink Max Portable Speaker. Big stereo sound and deep bass gives people the music they can feel. Whether you're at a chill hang or an all-out bash, when you've dropped your playlist, the party is on. Bose SoundLink Max Speaker. Start the party at Bose.com/Spotify Speaker.
At Sephora, we know how you love to use makeup, skincare, hair care, and fragrances that work for you, but also how important it is to be in the know about the ingredients that are in them, which is why we created Clean at Sephora. Curated products from brands like Merit, Amika, Summer Fridays, and Fleur that have everything you want, minus certain ingredients you might not. Clean at Sephora is only at Sephora. Shop now at Sephora.com.
What's up, all of our liberty-loving friends? This is another fantastic episode of Good Morning Liberty. My name is Nate Thurston. Our co-host Charlie is not here right now because he's never here. I don't know if he hates Ben or something like that. I'm not sure what the deal is. I am joined by Benjamin Iannian, who's a commentator for Young Voices. Ben, how you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me back on. Maybe one day I'll get to meet Charlie.
The mythical Charlie. So many of our guests don't get to meet him, you know. I swear he's a nice guy. He doesn't actually hate you. He's just always busy, you know.
I understand.
Yep. Why don't you give everyone a little introduction for yourself? You've been on the show a few times before, but if they didn't hear those episodes, who are you? What do you do?
Yeah, as Nate, you know, as you said, my name is Benjamin Iannian. I graduated from the University of Minnesota a little more than a year and a half ago. I majored in philosophy and double minored in business, law, and political science. I've been writing with Young Voices, which is a nonprofit for young pro-liberty commentators, for about 2 years now. I've been with them, and I'm actually getting ready to go to law school here in the fall.
Nice. I looked into writing for Young Voices. It turns out you need to be young. That's one of the problems. I aged out of their age limit, you know? So
we got to raise the age requirement.
Okay. So one thing we have here today to talk about is a spending package that just sort of, I don't know, flew under the radar. I don't know if people know this, but the government almost shut down. We almost had mayhem around the entire United States. We did luckily find a way to continue funding the government and spend a whole bunch more money that we don't actually have. And you wrote a piece about that. And why don't you tell us some of the details of this? You say the bad, the ugly, and the worst. You didn't say good in any of this. What are some of those bad and ugly things that happened?
Yeah, so as you just pointed out, the title of the article I wrote is The Bad, the Ugly, and the Worst of the Spending Package. Most people look at, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I didn't think there was much good at all worth talking about. So Congress did, you know, avert a partial government shutdown by passing a $1.2 trillion spending package. The media, this is one of my biggest gripes with the whole event, is that the media, you know, characterized passing this bill as long overdue. Different politicians like Chuck Schumer said that it was exemplary of completing the job, you know, passing this spending package, which really just grinds my gears as someone who advocates for limited government and fiscal responsibility. Democrats and Republicans get to go to their bases and tout their couple of victories without talking about all of the bad things that they believe the other side got in this $1.2 trillion package as well. And so it's a great opportunity for politicians to push propaganda on voters. Hey, look what I got passed for you guys, without talking about all the terrible stuff that was in the bill they voted for as well. And so I'll start with the bad, and then we can discuss that a little bit. So the bad of this bill, or now law, signed into law, in my view, was the actual contents. And the biggest problem in it, I think, what we should focus on are the earmarks in these bills. So earmarks are just funding, basically, that different representatives, people in Congress can basically get dibs on federal funding for pet projects in their districts, right? And so they get to take federal funding and push it towards their constituents, really, is how earmarks work. And there were a couple of really, really odd earmarks. Now, all of them are bad, I would argue. Why is federal funding going to specific state pet projects at all? But a couple of them, just to highlight, you know, how ridiculous earmarks can be. $850,000 went to a New Jersey housing development specifically for LGBTQ plus seniors, and $400,000 also went to an organization that creates a handful of services, but one of which is gender affirming clothing for trans youth. Now, I'm not making any comment on the social issues at hand here. That's not what I'm necessarily trying to get at here. But the point is, regardless how you feel about these social issues, whether you support the activity that these groups are engaging in or you don't support it, I think we should all agree that taxpayer dollars should not be stolen and handed off to these special interest groups. If you as an individual want to support these sorts of projects, donate your own money to it, right? That it's your money. You can do whatever you want with it. Politicians should not be forcing this sort of spending on everybody else, the taxpayer base as a whole. And so, you know, Republicans also, you know, they put in earmarks. Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, she secured just under $4 million in federal funding for an airport expansion in Dade County, Georgia. Regardless of how you feel about the airport, why are federal tax dollars going to an expansion of an airport in the state of Georgia? That it's not necessary. And if you thought Republicans were going to save the day outside of Marjorie Taylor Greene and push back on government spending, unfortunately, you were wrong. The GOP was far more focused on banning LGBTQ pride flags from being flown outside of U.S. embassies. They thought that was more important than rolling back spending. They did not stop $200 million that's now allocated to a shiny new headquarters for the FBI in the state of Maryland. So now the FBI can more comfortably spy on and harass American citizens. Glad to see Republicans are really looking out for us. And they also heavily supported a $27.5 billion raise above current funding for the Department of Defense, even though the DOD has failed all of its audits. It's 6 years in a row they haven't passed an audit, yet the Republican Party wants to give the DOD and the Pentagon a massive raise. And so I think that the contents of the bill were the bad of the bad, ugly, and the worst.
Well, I mean, judging by the things that you picked out, I would surmise that you don't care about our troops. You like domestic terrorists and you hate gay people. Those are the that's my critique of you. Welcome to the news.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly how the discourse goes these days. People, what I find interesting, and I know that you've probably had many conversations about this, the discussions that are had in the media and in public discourse all turn into, as you just made some satire about, they all turn into moral issues. And the idea is, if you don't support taxpayer funding of something, that means you hate whatever people that money is going to. And it's really unfortunate that no one just takes a step back and takes an overview and says, okay, regardless of how we feel about the object of this spending, is it the proper role of government? I think that's the conversation that needs to be had more.
Now, why do we get bills like this? Or why is all of this included in one bill that we had to sign to avert a partial government shutdown? It seems like if you want to avert a partial government shutdown, you would just decide to fund whatever things are at risk of getting shut down, and then we'll have some separate bills to discuss whether or not the federal government should give $850,000 towards senior housing for LGBTQ plus seniors or something like that. And if it's important to the people, then the people's representatives will vote on this. The Isn't that how it's supposed to work?
It should. And unfortunately, I think the reality is that our politicians don't really work a whole lot. I mean, they're there. I mean, they're in D.C. a decent amount, but they don't do a ton of work. Some of them do. Some of them really care about the issues. They're not just collecting a paycheck. I would say that those individuals are very few and far between. I'll say a couple of names. Thomas Massie, I think, is a great person to follow. Rand Paul is pretty good on a lot of issues. Hopefully, Justin Amash will find his way into the Senate. He's currently running in Michigan right now. So there's a few politicians out there who really, they give a crap. And they really look at all the issues. They advocate for better governance. Problem is, a lot of politicians are really there for the power. They're there for the dinner parties. They're there for the paycheck and getting to stand on their soapbox instead of actually doing work. And so a lot of these spending bills are negotiated by party leadership in back rooms. The bills are then released to everyone in Congress, really normally less than 2 days before they're supposed to be voted on. And these bills are over 1,000 pages. I mean, very few of these politicians, I would argue none, even the ones that you like, are not going to get through, 1,000 to 1,500 pages in 30 hours to look at all of the nitty gritty details. And even if they did, they would find so much that they don't like that they would vote no. Mm-hmm. It's a terrible process. We should have single issue spending bills. We should not be funding the entire government and all the pet projects everybody wants 1 to 2 times a year, right? This should be that all of these things should be broken up. And oddly enough, the government would probably not be allowed to spend as much money if they did that, because then if you had debate, if you had to spend time voting on all of these separate issues, you probably wouldn't be able to lump this many different objects within a spending bill. And so, the government likes to grow. It likes to, hold on to power. And so it is, they have an incentive to do it this way, because they don't have to work as much and they get to spend more money.
Now, I thought that Republicans were really big on having time to read the bills also. I mean, this is a 1,000-page document. It's not even a book. It's a legal document. And much of it refers back to previous parts of the document. You got to go back and say, well, what was 1C, the F, whatever that was. And it probably takes a lot of time to run through it. It's not like this is a page turner or anything for people to go through. And they had the 72-hour rule that I thought Republicans were pretty big on, but they waived that for this bill too.
Yeah, Republicans, push for a 72-hour rule where everybody would be able to have 72 hours. It's just how the rule sounds. 72 hours to read the bill before it would be voted on. Now, 72 hours still isn't a ton, especially when you have congressional hearings, when these, individuals, they have, different events or obligations that they have to go to. It's not like they could just lock themselves in a room for 72 hours, but at least you could get through a lot of these bills in, 72 hours. Unfortunately, Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House, a Republican that Republicans fought for, he waived the 72-hour rule, which was a huge slap in the face to all of the Republicans that wanted to see better governance come to fruition under his leadership. He waived the rule, and many Republicans were upset. People who are as different as Marjorie Taylor Greene and Justin Amash. Marjorie Taylor Greene is, I'm not saying I like this term, but at least you know what I'm saying if I say this term. She's a quote-unquote MAGA Republican. And then Justin Amash is a libertarian, right? And both of them agreed that this was a huge slap in the face. Marjorie Taylor Greene actually began the process of trying to remove Mike Johnson as speaker, and Justin Amash supported it publicly. He said that we should continue to oust speakers until one of them finally gets it. And at this point, that's probably the only way we're going to get better governance. It was really sad to see Mike Johnson break his 72-hour promise. And he also had a deal last summer. Thomas Massey, I believe, pointed this out at one point on Twitter, if you got, or X, if you guys want to find a politician talking about it. But as part of a debt limit deal, I believe it was last summer, Biden agreed to a 1% cut in all discretionary spending if they were still using what are called continuing resolutions to fund the government as of April 30th, 2024. If they were still using continuing resolutions, then he agreed there would be a 1% automatic cut in all discretionary spending. Mike Johnson totally gave up that leverage and pushed this bill through the House. Didn't have the spending cuts we wanted to see. Republicans were really big on border security. They did not get border security wins in this bill. Now, I know libertarians, for example, there's a huge disagreement about how to, handle the border. And I think that there's actually really healthy debate going on within the Libertarian Party about what that policy should look like. But I just want to point out that that was another thing Republicans wanted, whether, we like it or not is irrelevant. The point is that Mike Johnson gave up so much leverage that the Republicans had and pushed this bill through.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy that they gave up all that leverage. Do you think, speculating here, but why would Mike Johnson not want to push it to this 1% cut on discretionary spending? And Republicans are always talking about how we have to cut the budget, how we have to spend less money. You're talking 1%, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's significant in relation to all of the cuts that never happen to spending. So why wouldn't Mike Johnson want to do that? Is that political implications, election 2024, stuff like that?
Yeah, the question in my mind, now this is just speculation. I'm not a fly on the wall in any of these back rooms. But what I will say is I think it has to be political. I think the behavior we've seen from Mike Johnson over the last month has shown that political forces are really influencing his decision making. For example, he helped push through the FISA bill, which now which reiterated that the government can spy on American communications through the FISA program without a warrant. Right? Why would Mike Johnson suddenly, be a supporter of this? Who knows who's talking to this guy? Who knows what bureaucrats have his ear? But somehow he's become convinced that these bills that expand the power and the scope, not just the size, but also the scope of government, he's become convinced that they need to be passed even without broad support from his own party in the House of Representatives. It's really head scratching. I wish I had, a crystal clear explanation for it, but in my mind, it has to be political in some sense. Someone has to have his ear and is influencing his decisions in this manner.
One of the things that we always talk about is that, we can criticize these politicians all day and they deserve it. They deserve more of it, more than likely. But really, it comes down to the people, because my guess would be someone told Mike Johnson, hey, if you don't sign this FISA thing and there's some kind of an attack in the U.S., then this is going to be blamed on you for not pushing this through, and you're not going to win another election, and Republicans are going to be blamed for whatever happens in this attack. If you cut 1% of all of the spending, the news cycle is going to be, oh, look how many less meals on wheels we had this year. These people don't have any food. They're going to go to every single sad case that they can find, and that's all the media is going to talk about after that. And the politicians see that and they say, well, I want to win re-election, but who is it that's voting for them? It's the people. And so really it's on the people to have the right principles and to have the proper understanding of why, even if an attack happens, well, it's not right for the government to be spying on everyone. That's the cost of freedom is that sometimes you don't know every single phone conversation that's happening in America. Well, this person didn't get the same government funding this year. Well, that's the cost of not stealing more money from people against their will and inflating the way our currency. Like, you should have the moral principles to be able to see this and have it not affect your vote afterwards. And so I always go back to something, one of my favorite things that Milton Friedman said was that you don't have to change the politicians. The politicians will do whatever the people that keep them in office tell them to do. You want to change the people. It doesn't matter. If you want AOC to vote in favor of lower taxes, then just have all of her people tell her that she's going to lose her job if she doesn't do that, and she might consider doing it. You know, it's actually up to what the people in each one of these districts want.
Yeah, it's a great, I'm so glad that you brought up that Milton Friedman point, because it's such a great quote. He pointed out, as you said, that we need to change the incentive structure, which is, yes, what do people think? Are they informed? What are they knowledgeable about? He's famously said that, you know, we've tried putting the right people in office and that hasn't worked. The right people, once they get in office, become the wrong people. And it's important for us to make it, I'm not sure if I'm not trying to say these are just my words, because I actually might be quoting him, but he said that we need to make it politically profitable for the wrong people to do the right thing.
That's it for word for word right there.
Is it really? Yeah, oh my gosh. Okay. Well, I'll give myself a pat on the back, there I guess, for that one. But it's one of my all-time favorite quotes. I'm so glad that you brought it up, because it's really important for individuals to be informed about this stuff. Now, there's a couple of problems we run into, and you can stop me if you don't want to get too much into the weeds on this. But first, right, we have a chicken and the egg problem, okay? Are we going to have people who basically push the government to become more responsible, more freedom-loving, or is it going to start with a figure? Not like we should never put our hope behind an individual person, but or is it going to be a couple of politicians, right? Let's say Justin Amash wins his election. Let's say Thomas Massie, you know, stays in office for a long time. Rand Paul, you know, he's not quite Ron, right? I know everybody loves Ron, but Rand Paul is very good on a lot of issues. Again, he's definitely not Ron, but he is very good on a lot of issues. These individuals, maybe there could become a cohort of individuals. Chip Roy is okay on some issues for sure. He's pushed for more responsible government. They could push these ideas, and then individuals could latch on to the ideas, right? And then people could, you know, change other politicians. So we have a chicken and an egg problem of where's it going to come from? And the second problem, right, that's attached to that is the lack of incentive for individuals to be informed, right? And so that's where I think it almost has to come from a group of politicians first. Like, maybe we get our own Javier Milei, you know, in the United States, the Argentinian president. But because there's a great book called, now I'm not advocating for the title, right? It's the book is a thought experiment called Against Democracy by Jason Brennan, right? It's just a thought experiment. He's not saying to tear down democracy, and I'm not saying to tear down democracy, but it's a great thought experiment about the good and the bad parts of democracy. What would an alternative system look like, and why do we have problems with our current system? He doesn't say we should change our system. It's just an honest examination. And the idea is there is so much that the government does. There are so many stories, so many issues. And on top of that, as a voter, right, not only do you have a life, right, you have a job, you have hopefully, you know, family and friends. On top of that, right, your vote, the odds that you break a tie are next to zero. You have a better chance of getting struck by lightning twice. And so the idea is the incentive structure great for people to be informed? I know this is a little pessimistic, but I don't think the incentive structure is great for people to be informed. And so what we need are a couple of I think we need individuals, right, who care about public policy to basically put these pro-liberty ideas out more, right? I don't think people are exposed to them enough. Between Fox News, CNN, MSNBC, all of these news networks, and even go to the Wall Street Journal, right? New York Times, Washington Post. There's not a lot of libertarian ideas in these papers. There's some on economics in the Wall Street Journal, but not a whole lot. George Will in the Washington Post put some forward, but that's one guy. So the point is, I think we need an intellectual movement, you know, for the pro-liberty stance. I'm not advocating for intellectual capture. I think bottom-up movements are fantastic, but we need pro-liberty ideas in higher education institutions. We need them in mainstream media. And yes, we need people running for office who hold these views to push these views so that then people become more informed of them. And then I think you'll see more of a bottom-up growth. But I do think it has to start with the people who are already really entrenched in like the pro-liberty movement, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I can agree with that for sure. I wonder if it takes something bad happening to get people's attention onto that, like Argentina having 200% inflation, and they end up listening to Javier Milei, and they could probably quote more Mises than I could there in Argentina. I wonder if, relatively speaking, we just have it pretty good here in the U.S., and so we think that we can keep running up the credit card, and why not? It's not really affecting us that much. There was some inflation, but they also gave me some money, so it's evens out in the wash or whatever. And I wonder if it's going to take something, you know, with the Ron Paul movement, him filling up arenas, we had the housing crash, we had the bank bailouts, people were upset about that. I unfortunately think a lot of the Ron Paul people in those arenas turned out to be Bernie bros later on, because they were actually just upset about the bank bailouts, and that was their big thing that they were mad about. But, you know, a lot of people were exposed to that message. We do need a new, we need an intellectual, we need an economic Jordan Peterson that people will go and listen to for three. We need Milton Friedman going around to college campuses and talking for an hour or two in a civil way. I'm, you know, not Ben Shapiro going to college campuses and there being protests, but we need a new Milton Friedman, a new Ayn Rand. You know, we need people like that out there spreading this. This is something I did work for Free to Choose for a little bit. I don't know if you know that, but I started their TikTok account for them, and I was putting together all these Milton Friedman videos. That's why I happen to know a lot of Milton Friedman quotes, because I was listening for hours to Friedman, and I was talking to Rob, the guy that runs Free to Choose, and I said, man, what we need is we got to find a new Milton Friedman. Like, this is great. These videos are awesome. But Free to Choose needs to have a new Milton Friedman out there going around the campuses talking to people. And I don't know who that person is yet. You got any ideas?
I'm not sure who that person is either, but I think you hit the nail on the head. Milton Friedman had an uncanny ability to speak to a room of people who weren't experts on economics. Now, I don't think economics is a particularly complicated subject, and it's not. The media says it is, and people want you to think that it is, right? What we think of economics these days is not how I like to think of economics. You know, numbers, you know, a lot of equations, measuring GDP, this, that, and the other. What I think is most important is understanding the basic principles of economics. Thomas Sowell wrote a great book called Basic Economics. I highly recommend reading it. It's super long, though. So Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. It was written in the early 20th century. But it's much shorter, and it's a great book about the basic economic principles. Milton Friedman wrote Capitalism and Freedom. So that's another great book to learn the principles of economics. And we need someone like Milton Friedman to go out in the world and discuss the basic principles of economics. Now, I love talking about economics. I write on economics. I go on podcasts, TV shows. I speak about economics. I don't have an economics degree. I am not an economist. I don't think that that's necessary to do what Milton Friedman did. I don't quite have the same, you know, I think really special God-given like ability that he had. But what we might not have a Milton Friedman right now that we see, but what we need are individuals who come on shows like these, right? You know, you interview a lot of libertarian-minded individuals. I mean, the show is called Good Morning Liberty. You're, you know, a libertarian-minded individual. You understand the basic principles of economics. We need people like, you know, show hosts like you. We need commentators, people like me, other people at Young Voices. We need professors who are libertarian-minded to speak up. We need, maybe we don't have that iconic figure. And maybe that iconic figure will arise, but we need a group effort until that happens, because it's just too important to let this continue on, or we will end up in a, you know, Javier Milei, you know, Argentina situation.
You know, speaking on economics, you were saying like, you don't, people say it's super complicated, but it really isn't. It's just talking about how human beings react to incentive structures that are in front of, that's all it is. Like we can tell you it's not like libertarians or free market economists know the future or have a crystal ball, but it's common sense how human beings are going to react. And all these people who think about planned economies and that they can change the outcomes, they're basically saying that they can override millions to billions of human beings and how they're naturally going to react to the incentives in front of them. And that's why they end up being wrong most of the time. You know, people react to the incentive structure that's laid out in front of them. I keep telling people, I'm going to give a shout out right now. Listen to Words and Numbers, a great podcast. Listen to Anthony Davies, Professor Anthony Davies, I think is one of the most Milton Friedman-like characters when talking about economics that I've heard. You can watch his videos on YouTube, on the Learn Liberty channel. You know, he's got a lot of great ones out there, but that's been my vote for a bit on my favorite economist that's out there. And Ben, I don't know if you've listened to anything from him before, but you need to check them out.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to check them out. That sounds awesome. I'm always happy to listen to individuals that are just putting out really good content on basic economic principles. It's so important. Thomas Sowell is one of those figures. Thomas Sowell's still alive. Now, he's close to 100 years old. Yeah. So he's not quite as active as he once was, although he had a book come out relatively recently. The guy's written like a million bajillion books. He's fantastic. He had that same sort of ability that Milton Friedman had to discuss these sorts of principles with people. Don't listen to the media. Don't listen to politicians who tell you that economics is super complicated and that you don't understand it. It's all about principles. Forget the numbers. Truly. Sure, if the inflation hits double digits, be concerned, right? Understand that those sorts of numbers. But generally speaking, if you have the inclination to learn about economics, it's all about principles. It's all about understanding what effect certain policies will have on individuals in society. The economy is not this machine that we can go in with wrenches and screwdrivers and get it to run exactly how we want. It's an organic creature, right? It is made up of the decisions of hundreds of millions of individuals in the United States and all the people that we work with, trade with, contract with around the world. That's what makes up the economy. It's people. It's not politicians. It's not numbers. It's the freedom to contract. It's the price system. It's, you know, the buying and selling of goods and services. That's what the economy is. All you have to do is learn the principles of it, and public policy discussions will become so much easier, really, to dissect as just an average consumer of news.
And it feels like a really great time to talk quickly about your book that just came out. Yeah, why don't you tell everyone about that?
Yeah, well, I appreciate the plug here. I just released a book, the e-version, the Kindle version has been up since April 3rd, but the paperback just got released last week. It's titled Beyond Intention, How Progressive Economic Policy Initiatives Would Harm Society's Most Vulnerable. I know it's a bit of a mouthful. The second part's just a subtitle though. So Beyond Intention is about the most hotly debated progressive economic policy initiatives, right? I picked a handful of them, from raising the minimum wage to enacting rent control. I also discussed free higher education. You know, progressives want free college and universities. They also want Medicare for all, and they want wealth taxes, right? So those were the five that I focus on there. I take readers through each of those policies one by one in their own separate chapter, discussing why do progressives want to implement these policies? You know, what issue are they trying to combat, right? What data are they seeing that tells them this is a necessary policy, right? Who are they trying to help? And then I discuss, okay, what do basic economic principles tell us about how these policies would work in effect? And then I look at real world data of, you know, to show that in fact, these policies don't fix the problem progressives are trying to attack. Instead, they actually hurt the most vulnerable members of society even worse. And at the end of each chapter, I also give an alternative policy proposal to fix the original issue that progressives were looking at. I'm sure you can guess, it's a free market oriented alternative solution in all five chapters. But I really hope you guys check it out.
Yeah, for sure. And this is such an important topic that you're writing on, because I happen to believe that a lot of these people who push for these policies, I try to look on the bright side and think that they truly do want to help people and they truly do care about people, you know. And I wonder what they would change about what they're advocating for if they truly understood that these policies do not help the people that they're trying to help, that they're actually hurting the people that they're trying to help. And I mean, if they really, truly came to that understanding, would they still be pushing for these policies? Because maybe we can look at the government and say, well, they're pushing for this because they want to increase their tax base or they want to help this corporation or that corporation. But a lot of people on the ground, they care about these things because they care about the poor and they want to help them. And so it's very important for them to understand that that's not what they're doing, even if that's what the intentions are. You got to go beyond the intentions and actually look at what you're doing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You're 100% right. I think differentiating between the politicians and the voters, let's say, who support these policies, I think that's a really salient point to make that you just made. So the politicians have their special interest groups. They, you know, they're beholden to other forces that, you know, we don't like, that we don't know about. I like to think at least some of them believe what they're saying. Like AOC is a really young person, right? She's a millennial. I think she's a millennial. Lina Khan is a millennial, the head of the FTC, right? I think that they probably believe what they're saying. I know Elizabeth Warren was a very big, I think she's a very big political activist for a long time. I know Hillary Clinton was a political activist for a long time. She's not quite the same bold of progressive that the other ones I discussed were. But the point is that some politicians might believe at least most of what they're saying. Some believe none of what they're saying, and it's just a power grab. Bureaucrats, particularly a lot, and there's some good bureaucrats out there. Like there's some good people who just want to help. There's other individuals that just want to rise up the ranks and have a high power position in the government, in a government where there is more power. But the voters, 100%, if they are not, let's say, gaining anything outside of maybe social acceptance from peers who think how they think, and also a good feeling on their insides that they're fighting for what's righteous and just, right? If that's all they're gaining out of it, I think it's safe to say that those voters truly believe what's being sold to them by the propagandists in government. And so you and I have had discussions on this podcast before about, should libertarians be focusing on pushing principles, right, or pushing results of policy? And both are equally important, because if people don't understand the principles, even if you enact those policies, even if you get good results for a while, it might not be enduring, right? If people don't truly understand why those policies are working, it might not be enduring. And so that's why I try to do both. I look at the basic principles in my book, you know, so more economic theory stuff, the principles of basic economics. And then I look at the results, because I think that if we want to, let's say, convert, quote unquote, progressives, right, or just Democrats, or even middle, the middle of the political spectrum, to pro-liberty ideas, I think the hook has to be the results, right? If you just tell them, we love freedom, we want people to make their own decisions, I mean, they've heard that before. And they think that, well, I don't like their decisions, right? I don't support that. But I think that's what they would say. I think that if we start with, here's the results of the policies you support, and here's the results of the freedom policies that we support, I think then they might be on the hook at that point. And then they might dive a little bit deeper into the issues, and they might start to learn how these pro-liberty principles are actually, there's a great moral argument for them. Mm-hmm. And I think that they could then, grasp onto that. But it's my view that to get the people on the fence and far away from the fence to hop over the other side, I think it has to start with the results of policy to get them interested. But that's just my two cents.
I can agree with that. I think my only addition to that would be that the moral argument could help stop them from coming back and saying, well, that wasn't real socialism, or that wasn't really the policy. Yeah, I wanted this, but that got messed up by this guy and this guy. And actually, if it would have been done the way that I wanted it, then it would have worked out the way that I wanted it to. Maybe when you break down that wall a little bit with, here's how your policies are hurting people, you can also add in the moral principle at the same time to try to keep a little safety net from them going back and saying, well, this just wasn't implemented properly, we need to try this again, that kind of thing. Ben, this has been a really, really good conversation. I think my favorite episode that we've done so far. This is just gets better and better. I know we're going to have you back on after I get the book and I read through it. I think you've told me I have 4 hours before I can sign off on the book. And so that's how long I have to read through it,
Exactly. I'm gonna put you under the microscope, and you're gonna have to be like a member of Congress.
I know. If it were 1,000 pages, you said you'd give me 36 hours, but I think I'll get 4 or 5, something like that. So anyway, Ben, tell everyone where they can go to keep up with you.
Yeah, you guys can find me on Twitter at Benjamin Iyanian, and you can also find me on Instagram at BIyanian13. And thanks again, Nate, for having me on. All you listeners, as you know, it's a fantastic show. Keep tuning in. I really enjoy coming on. So thanks again for having me.
I appreciate that, man. Have a good one.
You too.